Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 11th of December. We talk about energy today. Sometime today, probably this morning, President-elect Barack Obama is going to be announcing the new energy secretary. His name, Dr. Steve Hsu, and he won the 1997 Nobel Prize in Physics. He said in a show on PBS last year, in the last 5 or 6 years, I was following the issue of global warming as an interested citizen, and it became more and more apparent to me that the dangers, the potential risks of climate change were looking like they were more and more likely, and that as a scientist, a responsible scientist, you really have to think of what you can do to help with this problem. He will be talking about this appointment. He is now running the Department of Energy's Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory in California and comes from an immigrant family of scientists, shared the prize, Nobel Prize, that is, with two other physicists in 1997. The president-elect met with Al Gore earlier this week, and they talked about global warming. We'll be looking at other possible people who will be added to an energy team, and a lot of focus on energy and refigurating the whole way that we deliver energy in this country. We'll be talking about that. We'll look at clean coal and if there is such a thing as clean coal and who Barack Obama is bringing to the table to deal with these many, many issues. We'll have two guests with us this hour. We start with Professor Ted Parson, who's a professor of law and professor of natural resources and environment at the University of Michigan. Later, we'll be speaking with the professor and chair of the Department of Engineering and Physics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And welcoming your phone calls, as we always do, the number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, you can do that at talk@wpr.org. Professor Ted Parson, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Kathleen. Thank you for having me.
Sure. It's going to happen sometime today in Chicago, probably at 9:40 this morning, which is the time they usually happen. Steven Hsu will be announced as the head of the Energy Department, a cabinet-level position. What do you think of this announcement? He's quite a qualified man, isn't he? But he has a very interesting background.
I think it's just a terrific appointment.
Do you?
It's a really powerful statement in several ways for the new administration. First, appointing a scientist of this stature to be the energy secretary really sends a powerful signal about the priority that the Obama administration is going to give to science in addressing issues of energy, climate change, and environmental issues. I mean, the Department of Energy is a funny organization. It has several mandates. It was originally established as kind of the civilian guardian of the nuclear weapons programs. In addition, it runs a big science and research operation. But in addition, it's kind of been the champion or the guardian of the energy industries in the same way as, say, the Agriculture Department is kind of the representative of agriculture and farmers. And these missions pull in different directions, and having a scientist of the kind of stature of Dr. Hsu in charge of it really says that science is going to be on top. And in addition to his record of distinction as a scientist, he has a real serious commitment to using the power of science and technology to solve the climate change problem. Lawrence Berkeley Lab already had a very distinguished record of research in energy efficiency and in renewable energy resources before he became the director, but he's built that up as one of his top priorities. So I think it's a great appointment in many ways.
Mm-hmm. And it really looks, considering the meeting with former Vice President Al Gore, who has been working, as everybody knows, on global warming, and Professor Steven Hsu's background here, this will be a huge priority for the administration and one huge issue, isn't it?
Absolutely. And actually, I think the other announcement that was signaled yesterday, although as I understand the details are not fully established, that also gives me great hope about the seriousness that the administration is going to put onto these issues, is the announcement of the Carol Browner appointment
mm-hmm.
to the new White House position. Of course, Carol Browner was the administrator of EPA under the Clinton administration, a very effective EPA administrator in some respects in some difficult times. And now she's coming back to this White House position to have kind of overarching coordinating responsibilities. I think this is great. I mean, the details still do remain to be determined. I think this is great because it indicates that the folks doing the transition really understand the breadth of the climate issue and how you can't, address the problem by working single agency by single agency, but you need a kind of an integrated, coordinated approach that brings in EPA, it brings in energy. Because of the international dimensions, it brings in state, interior. So depending upon just how it shakes out in terms of the mandate, the stature, and the sort of the process control that she has, this could be a very powerful appointment. I also have to say, it kind of reminds me of there's this iconic event in EPA history when William Ruckelshaus, who was the first EPA administrator under the Nixon administration, was brought back late in Reagan's first term to the same job again, to be EPA administrator a second time, to restore the morale and integrity of the agency after it had basically been looted by a gang of thieves during the first 2 or 3 years of Reagan's first term. And now Carol Browner is being brought back, not as EPA administrator a second time, but it's like she's being brought back with all of the experience and knowledge she gained running EPA the first time and put in the senior climate change position. I think it could be really powerful in symbol and in substance. It's like she didn't have the opportunity to do climate change the first time, but now she's coming back and maybe she'll get the opportunity to do it this time.
And what about, I don't know how definite this is, Lisa Jackson, environmental policy official in New Jersey as EPA administrator?
I don't know her record as well as I do that of Carol Browner or Stephen Chu. I took a quick look at what she's done. It looks like she's a very well-respected head of the Department of Environmental Protection in New Jersey. Indeed, so effective in that job that she had recently been announced to be promoted to chief of staff to the governor of New Jersey. Also interesting that her training is she's an engineer. She's a chemical engineer with a master's degree from Princeton. That's interesting. EPA has not normally been led by people with scientific or technical qualifications. It's mostly been led by lawyers. So that is an interesting signal, too. So I can't comment, you know, in detail. I don't know her record as well, but it looks promising.
And the other one, Los Angeles Deputy Mayor Nancy Sutley, Chair of the President's Council on Environmental Quality. What's that?
I don't know. Now, the Council on, well, what's the Council on Environmental Quality? I know what that is. It's a small office in the White House set up in the Nixon administration whose job is to advise the president on environmental issues. It's always been a vaguer, kind of more open-ended job than the other ones in the energy and environment space. So it has a couple of specific responsibilities. So it oversees environmental assessment. But other than that, sometimes the CEQ has kind of been the environment office that is mostly about symbolism. It's like some of my colleagues used to joke that it's like any time you saw the president pull on hiking boots and go somewhere to be photographed carrying a shovel, the CEQ was involved. Right? In some administrations that have been hostile to environmental protection, CEQ has been one of the lead White House offices in blocking things. So what it does really depends upon the administration and upon the priorities of the president. The speculation I had when I saw Nancy Sutley's background, which is very interesting, is that her appointment suggests the very interesting possibility that CEQ might take on a role as kind of the main liaison with states and cities on environment and energy initiatives because of her background in state and city government.
Hmm.
But I'm just speculating.
Yeah. And states and cities have really, particularly during the last 8 years, taken on this issue more than the federal government has.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the federal government has made some contributions by a very a good and consistent program of funding scientific and technological research, but in terms of policy and regulation and kind of engagement in the international process and leadership on the issue more broadly, it's really been nowhere. And to a very substantial extent, some states and a lot of cities have filled the gap, especially California, of course, which has been the real leader on very well-considered and ambitious regulatory initiatives to reduce greenhouse gases.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about what the Obama administration has laid out as their energy plan and how crucial it will be in re-stimulating the economy. We're talking about substantial changes here, more jobs in the green industry. What has he laid out and what can he do considering what's happening with the economy?
Well, he's laid out some very ambitious goals for transforming the energy sector to get greenhouse gas emissions down, for promoting the expansion of climate-safe energy sources, so investments in improving the efficiency of energy use, in renewable energy, expansion of carbon capture and sequestration technologies, which some people put under the very flexible heading clean coal, which is a way of burning fossil fuels without emitting the greenhouse gases. And also, he's committed to a very large expenditure program. I think it's $150 billion investment over 10 years and the creation of many, many jobs. Now, in one sense, an ambitious program of building up infrastructure and promoting new technology for climate-safe energy is absolutely crucial, and we just have to do it as a national priority. And there's some respects where that is really a complementary national goal to stimulating the economy to, you know, bring us out of the current recession and restore growth. Because, of course, the main thing you have to do in a recession such as we're now experiencing is spend money and get people to keep spending money to stimulate. The difficulty that arises is that there's kind of a mismatch of the times when the two things happen. It's like, to deal with the recession and stimulate the economy, we really need to find a way to spend money very quickly, get it into people's pockets right now, and kind of get it moving through the economy to kind of shore up the bottom. Many of the things we have to do to transform the energy sector and address climate change, they do involve a lot of public expenditure and investment, as well as a lot of regulatory things to motivate private investment, which is actually the really big action. I mean, the government can't do this on its own. But those take place over a longer time horizon. You know, we have to completely transform the energy sector to move to climate-safe sources. But that is a project of a few decades. It's not a project of a year or 5 years, let alone a month. And so we need to stimulate the economy. We need to find ways to spend money now. There are some things that the administration could do, the new administration could do, and that President-elect Obama committed to during his campaign that actually would advance both these goals. So a big increase in tax credits and subsidies for and improving the energy efficiency of homes, schools, hospitals, other buildings, you know, expansion of the weatherization programs and so on, that's huge. It gets you huge gains in energy savings very quickly, and it gets it through ways that can move fast and really put a lot of people to work, you know, people with existing trades and skills, because these are like building trades business. So, you know, when building is slumping, a big program of energy efficiency improvements is a fantastic way to get those people back to work. There's other things such as infrastructure spending on, you know, public transit, rebuilding highways, but doing it in a way where you think more about the configuration of infrastructure so that you're thinking about long-term effects on the environmental footprint of how we live. Those are things that the administration could start to be doing and spending money on, but it's probably a program of more over the next few years. Still hugely important, but doesn't have the kind of immediate stimulus that addresses the crisis we have this month.
We're going to welcome phone calls. We'll take them in a moment. We'll get back to clean coal, and if there is such a thing as clean coal, we'll ask the professor that question and welcome your phone calls, as we always do. Our number is 800-486-8655. Professor Ted Parson is a professor of law and professor of natural resources and environment at the University of Michigan. The president-elect is to announce his energy secretary today. He is Stephen Hsu, a renowned physicist and green energy advocate who is a Nobel Prize winner and runs the DOE's Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory in California, very interested in climate change and has made that a key part of his career. Well, what do you think about that announcement? What do you think about turning the economy green and how the president-elect can stimulate the economy doing just that? If you want to move us into whether or not there is such a thing as clean coal, we can discuss that. A couple lines are open right now, 800-486-8655. To you in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today. This book has been at the top of the bestseller list on the New York Times for a long time now. It's the story of Dewey, the small-town library cat who touched the world. Vicki Myron, librarian who wrote this story, will be with us the second hour of our program today. All right, let's go to phone calls, starting with Steve from Oshkosh. Hi, Steve.
Hi. The city of Oshkosh signed the U.S. Mayor's Climate Protection Agreement a year and a half ago. And since then, the city has been trying to figure out how to reduce its emissions, starting by doing a greenhouse gas inventory and such. It hasn't actually accomplished any of that, however. And I'm wondering how the Obama administration may change things for the city, like, for example, the city of Oshkosh.
Well, there's a lot of things that cities can do to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, although they really don't have the same power that federal or even state governments do. So what could the Obama administration do to help Oshkosh reduce its emissions? Well, it could subsidize programs to promote energy efficiency improvements in homes and buildings in Oshkosh. It could help promote increased penetration of renewable energy sources into electricity generation in Wisconsin. I mean, Wisconsin depends at present about two-thirds on coal for its electricity, so any cut you can make on that is really potent. Other than that, I mean, the powers that cities have are things like zoning, planning, permitting, local infrastructure, city transit systems. There's a ton of ways. I mean, they aren't the most powerful ways to influence greenhouse gas emissions, but there's a ton of ways that cities can spend more on these things, change the local policies and permitting procedures and stuff like that to make reductions. There's some cities participating in this through International Council of City Governments that claim they've made very substantial reductions, and I think the biggest hits have actually come from public transit programs, getting more people out of their cars and onto bikes, foot. Bikes are on foot in the good weather and buses in the bad weather.
Let's talk a little bit about hybrid cars and how important this may be in addressing the issue of global warming. Obama said that he supports putting 1 million plug-in hybrid cars on U.S. roads in the next 7 years. Is that too small a number? About right? Is it a possibility? How important is it in cleaning up the environment?
It's an ambitious possibility. Whether plug-in hybrid cars or moving to electrical drive-in cars is a good thing for greenhouse gas emissions actually depends entirely on where you're getting the electricity from. This is one of the big kind of the problems kind of looming around the back to bite you if you approach this issue a little thoughtlessly, because of course if you switch conventional petroleum-fired cars onto electric cars that are pulling out of a coal-fired electrical generating system, you get very little net benefit in reducing emissions. You actually still get a little because the electric cars are so much more efficient, but you don't get much. So the big near-term opportunities where we kind of know what direction of technology and investment we need to go to get emissions down are actually mostly in electrical generating. Because we kind of know what the set of technologies available for investments in the near term are to build new electrical capacity that emits a lot less or not at all.
Mm-hmm.
Transport is harder, and there's sort of half a dozen big technological options that people are talking about, and we don't really have a clear sense of which ones are likely to be most successful in the markets and which ones are likely to be most environmentally advantageous from a social perspective. There's sort of real risks in transport that we could prematurely commit to some technologies that turn out not to be that great, and then we're sort of locked in because, you know, the way the transport system works is with the vehicles and the fuel distribution system and the roads, it all kind of forms a connected network of stuff that makes it very, very hard to change once you've made a choice, kind of the way we've been locked into, you know, petroleum-based gasoline-fueled vehicles for 100 years. Since that emerged as the dominant technology around the turn of the 20th century. So electricity has the easier, early, clearer technological routes. Transport is hugely important. It's less clear how to proceed. Hybrids and plug-in hybrids can be good solutions if you're drawing on an electricity grid that is being increasingly decarbonized by moving toward climate-safe sources.
Mm-hmm.
But it can be a problem if you're basically building up a coal-fired electrical generating system to support huge increases in electrical demand that are going to drive your cars.
Interesting. Is there such a thing as clean coal?
Well, clean coal is a political slogan. It means what you want it to mean. No coal is really clean. But there's some ways of using it that are a lot cleaner than others. Right now, the environmental community is kind of split on what to do about coal. The Obama campaign has made a commitment to expansion of clean coal. What they mean by clean coal is the new technologies, that are often called carbon capture and sequestration that let you burn the coal and get the energy out of it, but not emit the carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. Basically, you separate the carbon and you stuff it into secure storage reservoirs underground, like old depleted oil and gas reservoirs or deep salty aquifers that are kind of thousands of meters under the ground. The surprising thing about these technologies is that they really look attractive on technology and cost grounds. And this is one of the biggest pieces of good news on the climate change issue of the past 10 years or so, that we could build full-scale plants doing this now. There's not a huge amount of technological risk about it because basically what you have to do to build these plants is assemble component technologies that already exist and are in use at full commercial scale in other industries.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a matter of putting existing pieces together and kind of tuning and tweaking and assessing the whole thing. There's lots more development work needed to get, you know, performance up and cost down and stuff like that. But there's not a lot of risk that the whole thing is going to fail. This is a way that we could build new coal plants with close to zero carbon dioxide emissions. That's what the Obama campaign meant when they talked about clean coal. Now, of course, the whole life cycle of using coal is still not clean. It's like it's dirty where you mine it, and it's dirty from transporting it, and you know there's all other social problems about it. But we rely a lot on coal, and we're not going to be able to get rid of it overnight. And certainly, building new coal plants with carbon capture and sequestration is hugely better than building new conventional coal plants, and in my view, is a real contribution, at least a near-term contribution, towards solving the climate change problem. It's not free of problems, no energy source is, but it's a lot better than what we're doing, and we could do it now.
Yeah, we'll have to do another show on that sometime. Matt from Eau Claire. Hi, Matt.
Hi, yes. I was hoping you could shed some light on your thoughts about, you were talking about infrastructure and highways, and when it comes to roads, what are your thoughts on asphalt versus concrete roads? Because you think about oil goes into asphalt and the cost of that's gone up and the environmental effect of that too.
Gee, what an interesting question. The short answer is I don't know. I've never thought about it. That's right. I mean, you know, concrete manufacturer, concrete uses cement, which releases CO2 in its production. I actually have some colleagues here at the University of Michigan who have an engineering research project called Sustainable Concrete. So
that's interesting.
Yeah, it is. There could be a difference. I don't know about it. It seems to me the huge environmental issue in road building and maintenance projects is where you put them and how big you make them, because roads embed for decades or centuries people's travel patterns.
Right. That's an interesting way to think of roads.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. And every day I look at how many roads there are. Isn't it amazing how our whole country is structured, particularly if you're in a city, by roads? Roads and alleys, and there are a lot of roads.
Absolutely, absolutely. And often, you know, often the roads went in first, and the form of the cities was basically determined by where the roads got built and by the investment in highways that allowed people to move out to distant suburbs in the 50s and 60s. So, you know, there's a lot of environmental problems that are really kind of set in concrete, literally and figuratively, because of the low density and the wide spacing of American cities. Because it's like, if you live miles away from your job and your kid's school and from where you have to go to do your shopping and, you know, your laundry and everything else you do and so on, it's like you're really committed to a lot of car trips and a lot of environmental burden just because of how spread out everything is.
Yeah. Thanks very much for your interesting question, Matt. And let's go to Christopher from Stevens Point. Hi, Christopher.
Hello.
Hello.
I'm very concerned about another kind of phase of this problem called peak oil. And I never hear discussions at high levels or by the candidates or anybody about the looming shortage of petroleum products and the massive disruption that might cause our society. Does anybody talk about that at your level?
A lot of people are talking about it. It's a very interesting and important question. What he's referring to, Kathleen, is just concern about the depletion of the cheap conventional oil and gas reserves that we've been running our economies on for decades now, that those aren't limitless and they're going to run down and we're going to find ourselves in a situation of there being scarcer and harder to get at and more difficult and more costly sources. This problem, it's a little strange, but this problem actually doesn't, it only connects kind of indirectly with the climate change problem. If you think about kind of the conventional, cheap, easy to pump out oil and gas, we're probably going to pump it all no matter what we do about restricting emissions of greenhouse gases to control climate change. It's only a question of how fast we pump it. And there are other energy sources that we can move to, which, you know, investors and firms and policymakers are thinking about. And in a sense, the climate change problem is really about the decision that we face as those cheap, accessible conventional oil and gas resources run down. Do we go toward heavier and more remote fossil fuels, which we process more intensely to get liquid fuels out of them? So do we move to oil sands, oil shales, getting liquid fuels out of coal? Or do we move toward climate-safe primary energy sources like renewables, nuclear, and fossil fuels using the carbon capture and sequestration, the cleaner coal technologies that I was talking about a moment ago? Basically, that's the choice that determines whether we will be really, really in trouble with climate change or whether we have a chance of solving the problem. If we didn't have climate change, what would likely happen is that we would shift progressively to more and more remote sources of liquid fuels from fossils, from hydrocarbons, you know, heavily relying on coal liquids and stuff like that. And everything would kind of look the way it does in terms of the energy system. We'd still buy gasoline and we'd burn it in our cars and so on. It'd just be coming from different places. But the emissions of greenhouse gases would be going way, way, way up because there's so many extra emissions upstream in the system when you move to those sources. So the key question is really, what do we do beyond peak oil and what kind of energy sources do we move to? There's many options to power the economy after, you know, petroleum gets scarcer and more expensive, but which ones we choose are hugely consequential for, you know, whether we have a chance of solving climate change.
Mm-hmm. Professor Parson, thank you so much. Please join us again soon and we'll really devote an hour to the clean coal issue.
It's been my pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Professor Ted Parson is a professor of law and professor of natural resources and environment at the University of Michigan. We're continuing our conversation about energy, just changing guests. The next half hour, Professor Michael Corradini will join us, who is at the University of Wisconsin in Madison in the Department of Engineering Physics. He has many fields of interest, including multiphase fluid mechanics and heat transfer, nuclear reactor safety, fission reactors, power plant operation and design, energy policy, nuclear waste disposal, and the list goes on. We'll talk a little bit about nuclear power and ask his thoughts about what direction the Obama administration is going in when it comes to energy and the announcement expected today of the new Secretary of the Department of Energy, who is a Nobel Prize physicist. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, you can do that this morning. Our email address, as it always is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org for your thoughts on the new energy secretary, what it is that the administration should do, and what it should do probably right off the bat to address the urgent issues of stimulating the economy and taking care of global warming. And this administration has its hands full when it comes to all kinds of issues. So feel free to join in with your concerns, your ideas on green technology and what needs to be done to move the country toward a more green technology and how it will help the economy as well to do all of that. So we're just landing our other guest, and we will continue our conversation. The second hour of our program today, a really lovely story about Dewey, the small-town library cat who touched the world. This book has been at the top of the bestseller list for a long time now because it's pretty heartwarming. Vicki Myron will join us. She found Dewey, who was put in the library drop of the library in Spencer, Iowa, some 20 years ago with frozen paws, and they brought him back to health, and he became quite the cat who received international attention. So that's coming up the second hour of our program. Professor Michael Corradini is joining us now, Wisconsin Distinguished Professor, Department of Engineering Physics at UW-Madison. Professor Corradini, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for asking me.
Yeah. Vice President Gore has said that early action on all fronts when it comes to the environmental issues is essential. Here's the message to Obama. We need to do all kinds of things, particularly act on global warming, because the scientific imperatives are getting more and more urgent, and we need this to stimulate the economy at the same time. Does he need to be off and running on certain environmental issues on January 20th, and what would they be?
Well, I would say yes. I guess the first thing that has been debated for a number of years, but nothing's really come of it, is how are we going to treat emissions of CO2 to the environment? Are we going to tax it like other emissions? Are we going to do some sort of selling of a cap and trade where you have some sort of allotments, but you raise money to begin with by essentially saying that everybody has to pay for their allotments and then trade on a fixed level? I think CO2 emissions is the most is a thing to deal with. I would say the other thing, too, is it in some sense, in my mind, a lot of this revolves around energy. I think in the short term, conservation or better use of energy devices, higher efficiency devices, has got to be tackled, and that'll help in the long term. But I think those are two quick things. I'll stop there.
Okay. I've never fully understood this cap and trade system. You just mentioned it. Can you tell me a little bit more about how that works and how it may be working already in certain places?
Well, there's a number of versions of it, and I'll probably get it wrong, but so let me get it as simple as I possibly can. The way I view it is if you'd pick some point in time, let's just say I'll pick 1990, the Clean Air Act, and you would look across the United States and see what is the amount of emissions of CO2 at some point in time. And then you'd say, okay, with that sort of emissions, we're now going to essentially allot that, and we will cap it at that amount. Mm. And then people would have to essentially buy a certain number, fraction of what they are going to eventually be allowed to emit, and they would essentially pay for that, almost like an auction, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right? And then once you do that, now you own a certain amount of, I'll pick some numbers. Say, for example, you have so many millions of tons of emissions for a utility in the upper Midwest, and then so you're going to pay for that up front. Now, once you have that, you can emit that much. If you need to emit more because you've built a new coal plant or you have a natural gas plant or you're not going to put on new techniques for, let's say, for carbon sequestration, then if you're going to emit more, you're going to have to go into the marketplace and buy more permits from somebody else. So it's essentially that's where the word cap and trade comes from, is that everybody buys in, they have a certain allotment, and then if they need more, they will trade with somebody else. And to trade with somebody, you have to buy it from them.
I see.
All right. So in some sense, that's a way. Another way, which I personally favor, is the cap and trade creates almost a marketplace economy for something that, in some sense, is an emission we want to limit. So another concept that some utility executives have favored is a strict tax, which is go back to some sort of 1990 or some sort of historic levels, and say at those levels we're going to tax for every ton of CO2 released so much per ton, and everybody must pay that, and it goes into a government fund, which can then fund new energy technologies or improvements in current energy technologies, right, to essentially reduce emissions, change the mix, provide an innovation fund for new technologies that may come up or new ways to use technologies.
Okay, I thought you...
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Thank you very much. You answered a question I've had for some time. What future for nuclear?
I think it has a good future. I think right now we're at about... nationwide, about 20% of our electricity is produced by nuclear power. That's actually a large amount worldwide. France is about 80%, but if you think France is part of Europe, Europe as a whole is about 20%. Japan is about 50%. Korea is about 60%.
Is it really? I didn't know
sure.
that.
Wow. Yeah, but if you look at the Pacific Rim, that is Korea, Japan, China, Hong Kong, that area, they're, as a group, more like 10 or 12%, right, because many countries don't have anything. But my only point in bringing that up is I think we're actually still one of the leaders worldwide, and I think it will probably grow, but it'll probably grow slowly. And the reason I say slowly is that the infrastructure to build any new power plant, or and we could pick another industry, but power plant, a stationary power plant to produce electricity, is quite complex. I mean, most people aren't aware of, but we probably have not more than a dozen coal plants being built throughout the whole of the U.S. right now. So only 12 plants in all the United States. That's not much, mm-hmm. right? So, in fact, 3 of the 12 are being built in Wisconsin because we have a moratorium on nuclear.
Let's welcome phone calls for you. We'll take them in just one moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. Professor Michael Corradini is our guest this half hour. He is a Wisconsin Distinguished Professor in the Department of Engineering Physics, a mechanical and nuclear engineer. He is with research interests centered in thermal hydraulics and multi-phase flow. He is especially interested in the areas of reactor operation, reactor safety, waste reprocessing, and recycle and risk assessment. And then you could send an email if you'd like as well. That is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program, I'm sure many of you have already had a chance to read this because it's been wildly popular. The author of Dewey, the small-town library cat who touched the world, Vicki Myron, will be joining us. Okay, to your phone calls now again, and let's go to Mike from Appleton. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, good morning. Boy, you need an engineering degree just to understand the professor's qualifications.
Yeah, I know. I thought, oh, he does this? What exactly is that? But that's another story.
Please don't laugh and hear me out.
Sure, we won't laugh.
Here's a low-tech grain of salt. It's an idea that would put tens of thousands of people to work and help in some perhaps tiny way to, you know, help with the global warming situation. Tell me, Professor, my understanding is that as the climate heats, as the Earth heats up, we're starting to lose our polar ice caps. That means that there is less reflectivity. Since, you know, they're white, they reflect the sun's rays. So as we lose that, it's a vicious circle. It just gets warmer and warmer.
Right.
So what would happen if we started to, and we could start tomorrow and put tens of thousands of people to work on painting all of our roofs white? Think about it. How many square miles of roofing is there, let's say, in the entire United States?
There's a lot, but I think I have two reactions to this. One is I commend you to try to come up with ways to improve things by some sort of technological approach. I guess my only pragmatic engineering part of me says that even though that's a lot, the land area where there's actually population compared to the polar ice cap is probably a fraction of the polar ice cap. So I don't disagree that one could do things like that, but I'm not sure how much of a quantitative effect it would have. I think if I might just go one step further, I think the way you're thinking, which is what can people practically can do in their lives to affect it, is the right sort of thinking. I'm not sure I might go paint my roof, although it turns out I happen to have a funny-looking roof in Wisconsin right now since it's about got 10 inches of snow on top of it, so I think it's nice and white at the moment. But I think your biggest point, which I would agree with, is people ought to think about this and kind of think through what can they do locally
right.
to make a change.
Yeah.
I mean, for example, my wife always is pushing me, and I agree with her within my limits, to change out all the lights in our house to compact fluorescents, right? That's a very effective way to reduce energy use, which then kind of cascades to how much I need, which cascades to how much I emit by the byproduct emissions.
Mm-hmm.
So,
thanks so much for your thinking and calling, Mike. And I think people are hungry to do something. They already have, but they need a national movement to join, don't you think?
Well, I think so. I think I do think though the number of papers have carried it yesterday and today that the new energy secretary is going to be coming out of a laboratory in California, Lawrence Berkeley Lab, and Dr. Chu, if that is the appointment, is very focused initially on more efficient energy producing devices so that you can right reduce the amount or reduce the growth in the amount of energy we need as our population grows.
It's quite an appointment, isn't it? A Nobel Prize in physics who's made global warming really a centerpiece of his life. Are you happy with the appointment?
Oh, yes. I wish him well. He's going to have a tough job ahead of him, particularly in these economic times.
Yeah. Let's go to an email. I've been predisposed to be against nuclear power, but now I think I'm basically agnostic since it does provide power with no carbon emissions. I thought McCain's promise to solve the energy problem with 40-plus nuclear plants was totally unrealistic because of the huge costs involved. So what is the hard reality about nuclear power in the mix of energy sources that will reduce climate change danger? David in Menominee.
Well, I guess so. I'm going to be very realistic. I think anything is going to take time. For example, and this is a slightly long answer, and I apologize. For example, President-elect Obama has suggested that investing in infrastructure is a way to get us out of this economic malaise we're in. And I actually agree with him. Many people feel that's not going to happen fast enough, but I don't think being fast enough necessarily is the smart thing. If you invest in infrastructure, road infrastructure, energy infrastructure, chemical plants, things that we're going to need down the road, we will be richer in the long run. So the answer to the gentleman's question is I don't think 45 plants will ever come, but I do think in the next 10 or 15 years, you're going to see about a dozen new nuclear plants. So that is going to essentially keep us at the fraction of nuclear electricity we have now, maybe a little bit more. But that in and of itself is an enormous contribution to reduce emissions. If you were to shut down all the nuclear power plants today, you've then reduced about 75% of your emission-free generation of electricity. The other 20-some percent is hydroelectric. So nuclear has an enormous impact on emissions. And so, but I think the point that the gentleman was raising is a fair point. It's going to take time because anything that's a complex construction-build project is not going to happen overnight.
We go next to George from Chaseburg. Hi, George.
Oh, good morning.
Hi.
Well, I was originally just going to talk about a book by Heinberg, Richard Heinberg, called Everything, Waking Up to a Century of Minds. But first, in reaction to the weight and several callers, for both coal and nuclear, I mean, I think realistically, people have to look at the total fuel cycle of both of these sources. And not, I mean, for either one, I mean, clean coal, for instance, I mean, is absurd in the sense that, I mean, I think by, 2010, they're saying that the Appalachians will have topped enough mountain range to equal the size of Delaware. That, and no sane person could say that's a clean source just by that reality, let alone finding places where you could sequester CO2 in that grade. And besides that, it's not an answer to our immediate needs just because it's going to take 10 years to develop, 10 years after that to build a coal plant. As far as nuclear, again, the fuel cycle, as we dig more uranium up, the actual percentage of what we need out of the uranium as far as 235 decreases, and you're going to just have to dig up that much more ground and that many more miles and contaminate that much more area. In fact, Bush just recently said he wanted to okay the mining very close to the Grand Canyon and thus the Colorado River and 25 million people downstream from that. Back to Heinberg's book, he basically paints a very grim picture in the fact that all these things, including lots of green things, I mean, he's basically saying that there's going to be a collision course between the world's population, the demand, and the scarcity of several things, whether it's water or the fuel resources, that we basically have to meet those realities.
Professor Cordini.
Well, I can't disagree with a lot of what the caller has said. I would only say that practically something like 75% of our electricity comes from either coal or nuclear, about 50-something percent of coal, and then, as I said, 20% from nuclear. So I don't disagree what he said, but the fact remains that these resources have to be extracted. I think I only know about details about nuclear, so I've got to be careful. I would totally agree with coal that I think we rely too much on coal. If I had my perfect mix of resources, I might have nuclear a quarter of all our electricity. I'd have coal a quarter. I'd push very much for renewables and some sort of flexible, when I say renewables, I'm including hydro, and then some sort of flexible alternatives. But I guess you still have to mine a lot of material for any of this construction. And I guess I'd only remind the caller that it's not just the fuel. It is also all the capital-intensive construction you have to do for renewables that you have to consider. So, I'll give you one statistic as an example, and that is if you're worried about CO2 emissions, nuclear has emissions because it uses fossil fuels for parts of its fuel cycle. It's about the same as wind. Because you have to build the wind turbine somehow, and they rely on all the fossil energy for the electricity to manufacture the wind turbines. So you've got to look at the complete fuel cycle or the complete life cycle of an energy technology and then make some hard decisions. But all that he says about concerns about environmental effects of resource extraction are absolutely true.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, George, so much for the call. Ron is next. Hi, Ron.
Good morning.
Hello.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Okay. My idea is to do with electric cars. Why don't we move towards manufacturing electric cars and then use individual solar collectors to charge the batteries?
You could do that. That's nothing. Nothing stops you from doing that. I would just simply, you were going to have to pay for the cost of that, and it won't be cheap. I guess that's my only point. So that is, to the extent that you're willing to do that, that's a perfectly technologically feasible way. It may not be economically feasible. That is, you might be willing to pay for it, but others might not. The cost of solar photovoltaics is something on the order of 5 to 10 times more expensive than making electricity by nuclear. So I just want to make sure that we separate what's technically feasible versus what people are willing to pay for.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Ron, for the call. Jeff from Chicago is next. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, how are you?
Fine.
Call me stepping out of my car.
Oh.
My question for the professor is, have you ever looked at the making of nuclear reactors, solid-state sealed nuclear reactors, where it vaporizes liquid mercury and the condensation process picks up through a thermocouple system the electricity. So my question is, can you talk about ultracapacitors, thermocouples, various types of energy storage systems, and air compressor cars? And are you familiar with quasi-turbines?
Well,
oh, Jeff, you're beyond us here.
There.
So yeah, we have about a minute left. We have about a minute left.
Okay, so your first question, I think what your interest or what you were bringing up is the idea of high temperature process heat to essentially use a different sort of cycle. That was studied many years ago at Stanford. Actually, I was deciding whether I could afford Stanford at the time, and I remember reading about the professors out there. I think that's very doable again technologically. We're back to cost again, right? And materials. It's going to take some very exotic materials to make that work. And the other two things you said, I've heard of them, but I don't know enough to comment.
And thanks very much for the call. We probably shouldn't take another call. I'm tempted, but we don't have enough time. Well, what is striking to me is how much there is to do. There's so much to do, isn't there?
Yes, there's a lot to do. And I think, I guess if there's a message to your audience, my simple message is that if people are going to worry about this, which I think they should, or at least try to be helpful in their lives, they want to think of practical things they can do in the short term, and then pay attention and be kind of an attentive public for the things out a couple years, and then be very judicious, because it's not just technical. It's partly economic, it's partly environmental as to what you want to choose to do.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for being with us.
No problem.
Happy to do it. Yeah, we'll be with you again, that's for sure. What an interesting hour. Our guest this half hour, Professor Michael Corradini, who's a distinguished professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison in the Department of Engineering Physics. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Thank you, everybody, for all of your calls. Many of you really know this subject. Don't go away. We have news coming up, and we'll have another hour of interesting conversation. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.